Hello and welcome to another episode of Truth News Radio Australia. It's the 10th of July, 2008, and I'm your host, Herewood Fenton. Tonight, the Garno Report. The ACT opposition says Labor governments must simplify the Garno Report's findings so the public can more easily digest its conclusions. We'll be discussing the Garno Report in detail, and we'll be looking at some of the scientific problems and inaccuracies in the basic propositions that underlie the report. Some other stories we'll be looking at tonight. Porn block trial complete. The federal government has completed a trial of blocking pornography and other online content deemed inappropriate for children at the internet service level. The Conspiracy Files, 9/11, the Third Tower. We'll be joined by John Bursell, head of truthaction.org.au, to discuss the 9/11 truth movement, his involvement, and to analyse and pull apart some of the propositions made by the BBC in their latest hit piece. So sit back and get ready for an incredible show, and I'll now hand you over to Josh Jackson to discuss the topics for today in more detail.
Yes, good afternoon and evening, everybody. Right, this Garno report, very serious topic, Herewood.
A serious and indeed an infamous topic in Australian news at the moment.
If the listeners don't know anything about it, international listeners, basically what's happened now is the Garno report, which is a fellow called Ross Garno, has...
An economist by trade,
has come out with a report about climate change and
The purpose of the Garno report, which was commissioned by the government, was to explore the ways in which an emissions trading scheme could be set up, and also to prepare the public. In my opinion, and I'm biased, right?
Yeah.
But in my opinion, the purpose of the report was to scare the general public into accepting whatever has been predetermined. Because the report is full of very frightening scenarios which have zero scientific backing.
The whole global warming thing is hysteria is full of unscientific, you know, hoo-ha.
And also fear,
you know. I mean, the whole... control through fear mechanism is extremely just overused in this area.
I mean, it's quite clear that they have used fear tactics to push an agenda. I mean, why would you bring in the Great Barrier Reef? You know, he's highlighted that we could lose the Great Barrier Reef if we don't employ these measures. Now, all the experts agree that if global warming and greenhouse is as they say it is, what we do now will have no effect anyway in the short term, okay? And even more importantly, what Australia does will have no effect on its own either, because we only emit 2% of the world's CO2. So
look,
Australia,
the fact of the matter is, folks, that during the medieval period, it was far hotter. This planet was far hotter than what we have now.
It was generally agreed to be warmer than it is now.
Through geographical surveillance and stuff like that. Now,
the medieval warm period is actually what it's called. Yeah.
And if you look at every timeline or graph, they always show the start of the graph starting at the mini ice age. And since the mini ice age, what do you expect but the heat of the planet to go up? And that is... absolutely because of solar spots and solar events. And you can cross-reference that because all the other planets are getting hotter as well.
What I would say, and I mean, I would say a little more cautious, a little more reflective. I would say we don't fully know what causes climate change. But you can pretty much say
that great big freaking thing in the air called the sun has got a lot to do with it.
But there are short cycles, there are long cycles. there are many effects that cause climate change.
Yeah, well, like for instance, 1998, we had an El Nino, which caused a far hotter couple of years purely from one weather system, and then it spiked back down.
Sure. The main point is here to, and this is a topic that comes up. This is a problem that comes up whenever we come up against official, acknowledged official truth, truth that's passed down from the authorities. When people question it, when skeptics question it, they are always put on notice or put in a questioning position, as if they have to justify their supposed claims. But you see, it's the other way around, Josh. In terms of the way I see it, we don't have to prove that global warming is caused by the sun. We are not required to prove anything. The government is trying to prove that global warming is caused by CO2.
There's not one white paper.
Let's let them try to prove that.
Because I agree.
They can't.
It's a very good point.
You see, yeah.
And because that's the way it's been spun. We're on the back foot now. We're playing constant defense. And to be honest, we should be in the offense because more scientists, and they keep going on about, the most scientists believe in the CO2 theory.
Well, yes. I mean, anyone can play the numbers game. And there's now 30,000, I believe, who've signed another petition. Originally, there was a petition. Well, it wasn't a petition. It was actually just the IPCC report. And there were people who were kind of they were involved in it, and they didn't even know what they were signing. But 2,500 names on the report.
And some of them said they didn't believe it, but their names ended up on it because they were questioned.
Yeah. I mean, so there was that report with supposedly 2,500, which was constantly trotted out. Well, now there's another petition with 30,000 on it.
30,000 scientists. And you know what they're doing? They're putting a class action to sue Al Gore. The head of that is the Weather Channel guy.
Supreme Court judge in the UK has ruled that Al Gore's movie, A Convenient Truth, is propaganda. And the judge has said that this should not be shown in schools because it is government propaganda.
It's highly political. All of it is highly political. If you look at the vast amounts of taxes that this carbon tax will bring in. Okay, let's step back to the Ghana report and the tax.
Sure. I mean, that was the lead story. Okay. And because this story now has been out for about a week, we're a little bit behind here at Truth News, but we're going to try to keep up with this story on a weekly basis. Now, the report was released last Friday.
You're right.
Yeah. The report was released last Friday and has caused an absolute storm of controversy. I mean, this has been dominating the news. Many people are against the planned emissions trading scheme. Many people don't even understand it.
Most people don't understand it.
And when people are told that a scheme that is going to change their lives, make everything more expensive, otherwise we're going to lose the Great Barrier Reef, oh my God, scare, freak out, crazy thing. But they don't even understand how it works, let alone understanding the so-called science behind greenhouse warming.
Let's step back for a second. Let's say that global warming because of CO2 is what's happening. Okay, let's just say that. Now, how is an emissions trading scheme that trades carbon going to do anything? Now, you've got to understand, folks, that when you trade, if there is no carbon left, which is the thing that they want to do, if there is no carbon to trade, you can't have an emissions trading scheme. So what you'll see is the perfect amount of price and the perfect amount of CO2, that a perfect market equilibrium that will constantly need to be there. Now, the market will make sure that we won't ever stop producing carbon because the price... because we can't stop trading it, of course. So you've got to understand this whole thing's a big sham.
I mean, look, it's going to become a giant bureaucratic system, and there's going to be a lot of lawyers who'll make money out of it. There's going to be companies that exploit loopholes in the system.
Massive.
As a scam. I mean, I guarantee it. I absolutely guarantee you.
If you look at, I get this all the time. Oh, You must be, scientists that don't believe the theory are funded by big oil. Well, hang on a minute. let's look at all the people, all the companies that are pushing the carbon trading scheme. And let's who first came up with the carbon trading scheme? Enron. Enron invented the concept of a carbon trading scheme. Biggest energy company in America and the biggest fraud case in America's history. In fact, in, I think global history in terms of fraud. Now, that aside, let's look at who's pushing it now that Enron's collapsed. All the oil companies want it. All the big energy companies want it around the world. Why? Ask yourself for 1 second why the big polluters would want a carbon trading scheme which is meant to collapse them.
Can I just point out that in all of the incredibly convoluted and, you know, obscure ramifications of this scheme, nowhere do I see a plan to increase the number of sort of, you know, say, bicycle tracks in Sydney. Do I see a scheme to help pedestrians get around better?
Well, in fact, they've taken away the 10 grand grant to people selling solar panels. They've taken away with the same breath of saying we want a carbon emissions trading scheme and an Asian union. In the same breath, they've stated we're getting rid of the 10 grand grant that Howard put in for solar panel sellers.
The solar rebate. Yeah. The solar rebate for family incomes over $100,000 has been removed. And that particular threshold is very important because the $100,000 threshold means that, yes, it is the wealthier families that do it, but that's the way it always is going to be with new technology. It's the people who've got the money who can afford it who will get to do it first. But when more people use it, it becomes cheaper because the economics of mass production kick in.
Oh, look at mobile phones. I mean, everyone was just a yuppie that had a mobile phone when they came out.
Yeah.
Yuppies and their mobile. Now everyone's got it.
But
little kids have got them.
By removing that rebate, and $100,000 is not a huge income for a family, okay? It's not. These are not the rich, wealthy elites.
This is the high middle.
This
class.
Is just the in even the average. I mean, yeah. Working husband and wife earning $50,000 each. What's that? That's just average. So this concept of labor is not benefiting the rich. They use that. You see, we're taking away rebates for the rich. They've misused that. They've used an argument there which is actually false.
Yeah. And let's look what else is going to happen. Now, they've talked about what's every so often they say that it's a tax. Very rarely. But they'll always go on about the emissions trading scheme like it's not a tax. Well, folks, it is a tax. That's blatantly what it is. Now, what they have said is the income that the government gets from the emissions trading scheme, that 50% of the money will go back to the poor.
Well, this is preposterous.
Detrimented.
This cannot work.
It's more socialization.
But it won't go back without strings attached, Josh.
No, of course.
It'll go back, but you'll have to apply for it. And you'll have to qualify for it. And they'll be able to put all kinds of
restrictions
to whether you qualify for it.
Not only that, more they'll be spying on you, looking at every part of your life,
getting
right into every detail of your life to make sure that you actually qualify. You're right, Harold. And but a lot of people forget this. Okay, now let's look at 30%. Where does the other 30%, another 30% go? So we've got 50% to the poor.
Yeah.
30% go to corporations that are suffering from the detrimental effect of carbon trading. So where does the last 20% go? The last 20% goes to new renewable energies and sources. So the least amount of the cake of the pie, which this whole trading scheme is meant to solve, is being sent to the actual problem.
This scheme is an insult to the Australian people. And if we take it lying down, we deserve the worst tyranny we ever get. Because if we take it lying down, if we just go along with this, ladies and gentlemen, And this is a call to action here. If we take this lying down, we should just basically, you know, put our hands down, be shackled and be RFID chipped and be herded off to the slave labor concentration camp immediately. Because that's all we deserve.
Honestly, this will collapse the middle class. And it won't happen overnight. You won't instantly collapse the middle class. They won't include petrol to start with, and they'll go, "Oh, we've got to include petrol because it's 40% of the carbon, and we've got to include every animal." So you can't actually go on a farm and live sustainably by yourself with one cow that you're going to slaughter at the end of the year, because that cow farts, and so you've got to pay your carbon. You've got to pay your carbon tax because it's producing methane. When we say carbon tax, it also includes other gases like methane. So farmers will be paying per cow a license. It's just insane. If you think, folks, that you're paying already a high price of food, if the world thinks they're paying a higher price for food and for petrol and for living expenses in general, you just wait until this carbon tax comes in. And that's what it is. It's a carbon tax. It's a tax on what we breathe out.
And that well summarizes it. And look, we don't have time to cover this topic in the depth I want. We're going to keep returning to it every week. We're going to be updating you on the progress. There is going to be a war over this, folks. This is not over. And we're not going to give in. We're not going to give in.
No. And it's important that you go and research people like Bob Carter, Professor Bob Carter.
We'll provide some links on Truth News Radio website.
Yeah, at the show notes, because it's very important that you find some of the people that are basically debunking this whole myth of carbon and actually look at the science, because that's the greenies always go, "You don't know the science." All the scientists and find the links to the 30,000 scientists that are saying it's a fraud.
There is a big split here between climate scientists and geologists. Geologists are familiar with deep time. Professor Bob Carter from Queensland is a geologist. Because geologists deal in deep time, geological time, they are well aware that the climate changes all the time.
Always
it gets cold, it gets hot, it gets cold, it gets hot.
Yeah.
And the changes are extreme. They are huge.
The world is never a stable climate. Ever. Never has been, never will be. It'll always be shifting. And anyone thinks that us humans can control the weather to always be one general temperature are so fooling themselves. On the line, we've got John Bursell from truthaction.org.au. He's a professional aircraft engineer and heads up the 9/11 Truth Movement website, truthaction.org, plus is a big part of the Truth Action, the 9/11 Truth Movement in Australia. John Bursell, how are you?
Good, thanks, Josh. And hello, Harrowood, how are you?
Good evening, John. Great to have you on the show.
That's good to be on the show. I've been listening to it for the last few weeks, watching it develop.
That's very, very heartwarming to hear. You're one of a hopefully growing small band of listeners.
Yeah. John, you've got a couple of events lined up this September. Do you want to tell us about them?
Yeah, we've got a trilogy of events coming up in September, starting on September 11 with a public meeting at the Tom Mann Theatre in Surry Hills, just a few minutes' walk from Central Station, so people will find it very easy to find. Then on September 12th, we're showing the premiere viewing of Shadow Play, the first Australian 9/11 truth movie, documentary by Gillian Norman. And then on the Saturday the 13th at the Bat and Ball Hotel, just opposite Moore Park there, also in Surry Hills, we're having a fundraiser and just a function for all the 9/11 truthers to get out and about and meet each other and have a few drinks and a bit of a dance, hopefully. There'll be a band playing and should be a great night.
Sounds terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the Truth Action that's happening tomorrow on Friday, where's that going to be held, and if anyone wants to come along and join us?
Okay, we're back to our old haunt at Town Hall again after a recent campaign in front of the ABC. We're back at Town Hall.
That's so actually tomorrow, from 11, folks.
We'll be back at Town Hall from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then we're having a planning meeting at the City of Sydney RSL Club on the fourth floor from 4 p.m. Probably finish up about 6 p.m. just to go over the plan for the upcoming events in September and through the rest of the year.
Fantastic. So, John, how did you, you know, get into all this, and what actually woke you up to 9/11?
Well, in February 2006, a friend of mine sent me a link to Loose Change, second edition, and I watched that movie closely, and I was amazed at the things I didn't know about 9/11. You know, I was always skeptical about the Pentagon, and I was amazed that the buildings collapsed, that I'd put it down to poor building standards and the unusual situation and the unusual type of buildings they were, but I wasn't aware of Building 7 at all. And, you know, I also was astounded at the military's, what they threw out in that day as far as air defence. I was amazed at how those planes could fly around the sky, because I knew that couldn't happen in Australia, but I thought in America the airspace was a lot tighter from my experience in
now,
the
John,
airline industry.
As a licensed aircraft engineer, you must have had some thoughts about the aspect of the aircraft involved in this. And I know that you're actually an expert in the Boeing 757-767 series. I'm just wondering, like, when you first started to look into this, how it struck you in terms of, like, what you know about what these planes can do, what, you know, what the level of, I guess, professional skills are required to pilot them. And, you know, when you started looking into the official narrative of what occurred on 9/11, how did you apply that to your what your knowledge is about these planes?
Well, like I said, with the Pentagon, I was always skeptical because of the proximity of the aircraft to the ground and the trajectory it had to follow to get to the Pentagon. That always seemed very strange. But, yeah, from my experience with the aircraft, I had worked in the simulator building at the airport there, and I'd actually flown the 767 simulator many times, and also during training on my 767 license course in avionics. And, you know, when you fly a big aircraft like that, it's completely different to flying a small aircraft where it reacts instantaneously to your input into the yoke. On a large aircraft like that, you put an input in to the aircraft and it takes quite a considerable amount of time before the aircraft reacts. And then you end up in a situation, if you're not used to controlling the aircraft, that it starts to porpoise all over the place and you end up in these continuous manoeuvres where you really can't maintain any attitude or any real control over the aircraft. And it's just something that you only can do if you've got the natural talent for flying, and two, you've got the experience in the aircraft type, because each particular aircraft reacts differently. The bigger the aircraft, the slower they are to react. So thinking that these amateur pilots, or, you know, these hijackers that we really have no evidence they really even exist on the aircraft.
Well, the ones that nine of them showed up
the thing. Live. Yeah, and actually even just hitting the buildings, like a lot of people say, oh, it's easy to hit these buildings, but at the speeds the aircraft were flying, they still had to maintain good control on the aircraft and keep it at a constant, you know, attitude and a constant lateral trajectory, and that's very, very difficult to do unless you're a good pilot, unless you're using the autopilot. But we've been told that these pilots flew the aircraft manually. That's what we've been told.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard suggestion that perhaps they plugged a waypoint into the flight computer. And, I mean, these are very complicated subjects, which we're not really going to get into tonight. But, you know, the questions, no matter which way you look at it, are complicated. And it seems like no one's ever really addressed them. And the 9/11 Commission I've read the section of the report that deals with this. And they don't even explain how the pilots basically navigated. They don't even address it.
John, you mentioned once to me about a beaker that is always on, and it's a friendly beaker. Explain how that works.
A beacon you're talking about?
Oh, the beacon, yes, sorry.
The transponder beacon?
Mm.
Well, I'm not sure in regards to what we were talking to, but, I mean, normally on a civilian aircraft, there's a air traffic control beacon that transmits an identification code for each particular aircraft so that the air traffic controller are aware of it, and also gives an attitude with as well. So they know basically what altitude the aircraft is and what aircraft it is. And then they also have the obviously the primary radar signal that they get from the radar returns. But the transponder actually sends a signal to the tower so they can identify the aircraft. On 9/11, all those transponders were turned off on the aircraft. Now, you might have been referring to the fact that to approach the Pentagon, you normally need an IFF or a friendly beacon that's, particular
right.
to military aircraft, which civilian aircraft don't have, to get within inside the perimeter of the air zone there. Now, I'm not sure exactly how that works. I know they've got an inner zone of about 3 or 4 miles, and they have an outer zone of about 50 miles. You know, if anyone's followed 9/11, they know that Cheney was heard to say in the White House bunker about the plane being 50 miles out, and that's when he first gets told about it as it's approaching the Pentagon. As far as I know, that's sort of the air-safe area that the automatic surface-to-air missiles are activated, and, you know, basically it's an immediate scramble to protect the buildings of Washington. But if you've got a friendly beacon, then consequently you can go inside that airspace and there's not this automatic reaction.
It's been brought up a couple of times, John, that there is an airport very close to the Pentagon that is actually a commercial airport. And mm-hmm. because of that, some people have said, some you know, I guess non-9/11 truth people have said, well, you know, planes are taking off and landing all the time at this airport. So the notion that the Pentagon is in some special protected airspace can't be true because we've got huge airplanes, you know, careening through the sky. I don't know if you can speak to that at all. It's just something that came up recently, and I've looked at the Google map and I've seen, yes, it is very close to an airport, but I'd imagine...
Is it within 3 miles or it'd be greater than 3 miles, I'd imagine?
Yeah, it's probably a bit more than that. But I mean, obviously a plane can cover 3 miles.
Within that 50-mile perimeter, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you know, basically if you've got a flight plan submitted and you're within that airspace, I'd say they just deal with that on an individual basis. They'd know which aircraft each day, because every aircraft that flies has a flight number and a flight plan that's submitted to the, you know, FAA in America's case.
Yeah.
So they know of exactly what aircraft's going to be taking off from that airport, and the air traffic control could differentiate between ones that are meant to be there and ones that aren't. And obviously they would never be flying over those buildings. As far as I know, no one flies over at those especially at low altitude. I'm not sure exactly what the altitude limits are within that airspace, but from what I know, basically no one's allowed to fly over those buildings. So those planes would all be taking off and immediately turning away from that area, and they'd be aware of exactly which aircraft were meant to be taking off. That's the only way I could explain that.
Yeah, and I guess the question of the, you know, missile batteries is something that we can't really confirm or deny. I mean, it's not as if the Pentagon advertises that, hey, yeah, we've got a bunch of missile batteries at such and such a location. I mean, it's assumed that they have missile protection, but we're not in a position to really be able to confirm that, are we?
Well, I mean, people like Bob Bowman agree to it, and, you know, they were in the military and the Air Force, and they were fighter pilots, and plenty of other ex-military people have said that they exist. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's just similar to things we see, like just with that BBC thing that came out recently where, you know, Stephen James brings up super thermite, and everybody sort of knows that's done any research that it does exist and it is real, but then someone can simply say, oh, well, you know, that's, you know, just what he says, how do we really know? Or they throw this doubt onto things all the time, and, you know, you can doubt anything, but, you know, the problem with 9/11 is that the doubts that we have are mostly real and verifiable.
Just on that topic, sorry to interrupt, but we have a bit limited in time tonight, but just to get onto this topic of, as you brought it up, the recent BBC documentary, I was actually quite keen to get a bit of feedback from you on it. Now, the documentary is the second installment by the BBC called The Conspiracy Files, and you'll be able to get that from our radio show notes. Now, the first episode was pretty terrible. It was full of emotive, propagandistic style of reporting. It had a lot of flaws in it. The second documentary which is coming a year later from the first one, focused completely on Building 7. It's called The Third Tower. I've sat through it. I watched it last night, and I have to tell you, it is worse than the first one. That's my response. It's so poorly done that I think that it's going to be quite limited in its ability to persuade anyone of anything.
Well, I sort of thought it was the first thing that struck me was the way they kicked it off. They said, "We all remember how the Twin Towers collapsed on 9/11." Okay, so straight away they're putting the idea into everyone's mind that we know how they collapsed. But you and me and Josh and everyone else is looking into it, the fact they've never explained the collapses at all. So, you know, straight away they're saying something that's nonsense.
They say how they collapsed. Yeah, of course we don't remember how. We remember that they collapsed, but not how they collapsed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. So it's really very Orwellian, the whole approach to this hit piece. But it was very slick, but it actually made me feel, it's funny, I know you say it's like worse than the last one, and it shows this desperation, but it actually makes me think that we've won. They actually realise now that we are going to get this information through what we're doing on the street and through what we're doing on the internet and all these other different, you know, we've got a new film coming out every week about 9/11. They've realised that we're going to get the information out to everyone. So now they actually have to present the information that we've gathered through painstaking research and people's efforts outside of the media, the mainstream media. They have to actually present that information to people so they can do it on their terms. And that's really what this is all about. That's what this documentary is about. It's about them being able to present the information that's going to get to everyone eventually in their own way, and constantly loading it with emotion and spin and, you know, and nonsense as well. And, I mean, maybe that's why you see it as such a bad documentary, because it's got a lot of nonsense in it. But, geez, it's got a lot of good stuff too. I mean, it basically makes our case. It just, you know, they say things like that all the materials were taken away from the site. And they say it as if it doesn't even matter. Like, yeah. I mean, you can make a whole documentary out of that fact, the fact that they tracked and removed all the material so that no one could ever investigate it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, from a crime scene, they don't even give it any emphasis. It's like, oh, well, that happens all the time. It's just amazing how casual they are about showing stuff that's revolutionary information, you know?
There are several points in the documentary where they contradict their own findings. I'm going to go back through it and make some notes, and I'm possibly going to write an article about it. Because, for example, there's one part where they are talking about the dust from the towers, and they talk to Stephen Jones, and then they say, well, you know, Stephen Jones says that the metallic spheres were caused by thermite, but then they say, we think it could have been caused by people doing welding, you know, during the cleanup after the buildings collapsed. And then they immediately cut to an interview with a guy who tells us that the dust was collected within 20 minutes of the collapse.
And so, a long, long way away from the site, yeah.
I mean, was somebody welding within 20 minutes of the collapse? I mean, they their own evidence does not support the assertion that they make in the documentary. There's several points like that.
The fact of the matter is that anyone that tries to rebut our findings as a movement finds it extremely hard, because there is just so much overwhelming, absolutely conclusive evidence that even if one of them were right, then this needs to be absolutely looked into, and a lot of people need to be brought to justice, and we need to look at the whole system that allowed this to be orchestrated. John?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, Building 7 is an interesting collapse. I mean, it's not exactly the same as a controlled demolition, and we have to be very, very careful that there's evidence of this in this hit piece with BBC and other things I've seen recently with Richard Gage and other people. Stephen Jones has been very, very good at navigating through this, but other professionals, including, you know, ourselves in Sydney and in Australia, have fallen into the trap of trying to come up with two detailed theories about how these things happen. You know, we really don't know how they pulled off these collapses. But with Building 7, it's obvious that it breaks a lot of physical rules. And, you know, the conservation of momentum, the speed of the collapse, the symmetrical nature of the collapse. But we really don't know how they got the charges in there or what sort of charges they were. And they did manage to hit us in a few spots that I thought hurt, you know, where they started talking about the idea that explosives might have been sprayed on or inserted in the building when it was being built.
Well, that was Richard Gage, and I think that was, I wished he hadn't said all that, actually.
You don't know how much he said, he said it was speculation, and what these journalists do is they'll keep pushing and pushing and pushing, trying to get, well, how could that be possible?
And then they selectively edit.
Yeah, and that's right. I'm sure Richard's realised that, and he'll see that they've made fun of him really with that. You know, he might be right. Who knows? I mean, on the street when you're talking to people and you're trying to explain things, they want these ideas of how it's possible so that they can get past the idea that it can happen at all.
Sure.
So we do get used to having to do that, but every time we come to the public or we go near a journalist, that's when we have to pull right back, and we just have to say, well, look, you know, what do you think happened? You know,
we don't know. I'm happy to say this, that I don't need to speculate. It's not my desire or it's not my place to even speculate.
Well, that would make us conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, I mean, we can look at hard evidence. We can look at Newton's laws of motion, and we can see that a building cannot do what that building did without some additional source of energy pulling
right.
the floors out away. And we don't know what that is. We don't know how they did it. And Marc Loiseau, the CEO of Controlled Demolition, Inc., makes the very valid point in the documentary that you need a vast amount of time, care, and effort to set up a controlled demolition. We don't dispute that. But that in itself should be seen as evidence that the building was deliberately demolished, because if it takes all that time, care, and effort to make a building come down in an accordion fashion, disappearing into itself, turning into dust, then it can't just happen by accident. Hello? I mean, it can't just happen purely by being hit with some debris from another building to get the exact same effect as 2 months' work of the world's top expert company in controlled demolition. That conclusion makes no sense, and the BBC is making a fool of themselves by leading with that.
They are, but somehow it sort of works in this strange way that we've been, over the years, over the last, 50 years, this media, the way they say things seems to have more emphasis to the normal person than the reality of things, and they seem to know that now, and just the way that they spin it. You know, you sort of feel, I even feel myself starting to have doubts, even though the things they're saying is completely nonsensical. So it's obviously a psychological game that they play by just being so relaxed with this information. That's what I really got. From this hit piece was it was just so matter of fact,
they're
illogical. To get to a point that you were saying, I wanted to flush out a point in particular. You're saying that they have to prepare these buildings. Now, what they do is they go in, they cut 90% of the columns of the building because buildings are built so much stronger than they need to be to hold the weight. So they'll go in and cut nearly 90% of all the columns ready for these buildings to collapse when they're going to do a controlled demolition. And this fellow is saying that, talking about all this work, and then the building, we're expected to think it'll just collapse. Now, we see some of these buildings that have failed in the demolition sequence where they have previously cut all these columns.
And they still don't disintegrate.
They stop. Yeah. They go boom, and they stop.
Yeah.
They don't continue to collapse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The argument that the whole thing can just seamlessly fall without any wham or I'm not sure if they call it wham or bam, but Frank Logan and a few others have been making theories about the fact that there's no slowing at any stage. There's no impact of when that initial collapse starts. There should be some stop or some slowing of the collapse at some point where the inertia of it is absorbed and then it continues.
At least on one corner.
It's just seamless, you know.
What did you think about the testimony of the deputy chief fireman in the documentary, John? Because I thought he was one of the most compelling people I interviewed, and he seemed to really believe what he was saying. How did it come across to you? Because I found that part, I was getting a little bit of questioning and doubt there, because he seems to be very adamant that, the building was not demolished. And he says that an engineer told him that the building was going to collapse in about 5 hours.
Well, I think this was the most compelling part too, but it was also had quite a lot of loaded statements, and you know, where they put up an idea, but then they don't flush it out. Now, what did he say? He said that he mentioned that they put monitoring equipment onto the building, didn't they?
Yeah, he said they'd put monitoring equipment, and he said an engineer had been consulted, and the engineer had said, based on the fact that there are fires or something, you know, based on what we've looked at, this building will collapse in about 5 hours.
That's right. Okay, so
even though there's never been one example in the history of steel structured buildings.
Yeah,
exactly, Josh. That's one of the points I would make, is that we have a man stating something's going to happen when he has no historical model for it. So that's and they don't mention his name. So his name's not mentioned.
Yeah.
They don't have a historical model, but then the fellow, you know, seems to think that this guy knows it's going to happen. They say that they've put equipment onto the building. Now, the equipment they would put onto the building, I would imagine, would be accelerometers and things that would sense movement, okay, of the building and to see any sort of signs of structural failure to begin, because these things we would imagine would happen slowly, so they'd have time to react.
But of course, if we run that through the prism of Barry Jennings' testimony, then indeed there would have been signs of that, because according to Barry Jennings, there were explosions in the building even before the Twin Towers collapsed.
Do you want to explain who Barry Jennings is?
Barry Jennings is a government, or was a government official. I forget his exact role or title, but he was a government official who quite well, you know, well ranked, who was involved in the Port Authority, and he was brought in to the OEM, the Office of Emergency Management. He was called in there directly after the first plane struck the North Tower. Now, I don't know, John, if you've had a chance to look at the recent, just today it was published on the 9/11 Oz Forum. Dylan Avery has released the full interview with Barry Jennings.
Yep.
Have you had a chance to listen?
I've watched all the interviews yet.
I mean, how do you think the full interview of Barry Jennings that Loose Change did stacks up against the BBC interview with Barry Jennings? So I thought that was very interesting.
Well, the more I watch of Barry Jennings, the more I think he's becoming confused. So,
yeah.
And there's things that don't necessarily add up. Like at one stage, he says that the whole section of the building's missing, but then he says that the stairwell collapses before the tower falls. And oh, I don't know. I'm sort of. He is adamant that he believes there is explosions in the building. I believe that of the testimony, and I believe that you know, that there were things that happened that he couldn't explain, and the way the building fell, he felt he couldn't explain either. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit sort of confused on it now, because after watching a few different interviews with him, it's not really that clear that... because you've got to remember that the tower that was furthest away that collapsed first was Building 2, and that didn't do bugger all damage to Building 7, just like a rush of hot air and dust and debris as the buildings collapsed. It was when Building 1, the first building that was hit that collapsed second, collapsed, that did the substantial amount of damage to Building 7 that we're told about. So I don't really know how it all fits into the timeline. You know, I don't know. Did you find that it sort of wasn't making a lot of sense, but there was things that he was certain about? But I think he's sort of been coached, or, you know, he's been probed by so many people now that he's sort of a bit confused about what's happened.
Well, his demeanour in the BBC interview is extremely uncomfortable.
And I thought that too.
He doesn't say anything, but the BBC doesn't even ask him the important question. And the important question, folks, is this. Were the Twin Towers still standing when he was blown up out of the stairwell on level 6? This is the absolute clincher question, which they didn't bother to ask. Okay.
Well, didn't the BBC stated, the explosion would have been the tower collapsing?
That's what they've said. Yeah.
When really, look, folks, an explosion goes like this. Boom, within a second. A tower collapsing goes...
Sure. I mean, the
and rumbles for like 10 seconds.
At least.
An explosion is... any child could tell you the difference between an explosion and an earthquake. You know?
I mean, it does introduce... I mean, they've run this idea. They've run this argument. Yes, what he calls an explosion is the collapse of the tower. But in his first interview with Loose Change, I was really pleased that he's absolutely adamant that that is not the case.
He's adamant about that, and he's also adamant that it came from below.
Came from below, indeed.
Yeah.
Obviously,
but I think he's been got out by the BBC, and it seems to, like, I don't know, he's not as certain as he was. There seems to be doubt in what he thinks now, that maybe they've planted some doubts into his mind, I don't know.
Well, the funny thing is, what he seemed to be most upset about was the claim that he was walking over dead bodies. And yet, in the BBC program, they get Dylan Avery in there, and Dylan Avery plays the audio of him saying he was walking over dead bodies. So,
yeah.
There's a little bit of, good reporting, good, at least the BBC went through the motions of doing that and showed both sides of the story, even though I think their whole piece is biased. Because do you notice when they showed Dylan Avery speaking, they had him swearing twice?
Yeah, because they frustrated him. Yeah,
yeah. I bet that he didn't swear all the time when he was talking. But they probably interviewed him for 2 hours, and probably at a couple of points he got a bit excited and used a couple of F words. Right, that was the bit that they showed you was Dylan Avery swearing, and that was chosen. It was so obvious that they chose that.
Well, that's what I was going to say before. Is that they're kings of wordsmiths. You know that they really are. That they every, like you said, John, at the start, is they use the word, you know, how the buildings collapse and stuff like that. Just simple, subtle words and including swear words in there from Dylan Avery. All this sort of stuff grows out to a big picture of seeing the 9/11 truth movement as being a little bit iffy on substance.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know if you noticed that they didn't use Jones very much at all.
Very, very short piece, yeah.
Yeah, he's very savvy with this now. He's been around a while.
Yeah.
And he's played this game quite a few times, and he's very good at it. And they didn't get much from him. They did get him laughing a little bit strangely a few times, which I saw they put in.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all worked against what we're after. And also we saw the usual thing about conspiracy theories of big business. I don't know how you can talk about big business when people are making, $3.5 billion out of buildings collapsing. That's big business, you know. Who is actually making a living out of 9/11? What, Alex Jones? And it's not 9/11 by itself. There might be a couple of other people.
Oh, he's running a news service.
By writing books, but all the people that I know that are even people like David Ray Griffin, they basically made all their money earlier in their careers, and they're probably going backwards due to their work. So, just lie after lie as far as who we are, who are 9/11 truthers. You know, they keep putting forward the argument that we're saying the police and the firefighters and other people are involved in this conspiracy, which I've never heard. Even the people that try to do us harm by going down certain paths with the investigation, I've never heard any of them say these things. So that's completely wrong, isn't it? So they keep painting us as these certain sort of people, and there's just no evidence for that at all.
The fact of the matter is that 9/11 truth movement's made up of all sorts of walks of life, from absolute career professionals in their 60s and 70s down to career professionals in their 30s to people in totally different, strange, teachers to nurses to, all sorts of people. So to paint us as some sort of conspiracy theory nutcase students that sit.
Sure. Know. Look, to summarize it, and we're probably going to have to wrap this up shortly. To me, what the BBC does is they try to draw you into their view of the world as being the most reasonable. And they kind of say, well, we are the most reasonable people. We are very objective. We are going to give you the grand picture. We're going to show you the evidence. We're going to show you both sides. And you're going to, from us, get a picture of reality. And obviously the picture of reality that they're trying to project here is that these people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job are either mixed up, confused, have some obsessions, have some emotional problems, can't face facts. In various subtle ways, the whole documentary had that. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that's right. That's what I was coming to. That all sorts of walks of life. There's also, John, you're an amazingly intelligent man.
okay.
Well, yeah, even. But you are, you know, you remember a lot of statistics and facts and figures, and you have to be in your profession. So how can, you know, these people claim that, you know, a senior professor at Sydney University is some sort of, you know, crazy conspiracy theorist?
And well, they don't seem to mention, the only ones they ever mention, the only academics or professional people that they mention are the ones that are getting the media. Now, you don't see them bringing up, you know, people like Bob Bowman, Dr. Bob Bowman, or you don't see them bringing up other people like, you didn't see them bring up Yukisa Fujita, you know, from Japan. They stay away from the people that have extremely good credibility, because they know that's suicide for what they're trying to do. And that, you know, that just shows how weak the BBC are. But one thing I can say for them, they did present nearly all of our arguments. It's just the way that they did it. Whether or not the public are waking up enough to look through the smoke that they've put in front of the evidence, that's another thing. I'm not sure. I mean, I've spoken to quite a few people about this BBC documentary already, and the consensus is mixed. I mean, people like Gillian Norman, who's a filmmaker, thinks that the BBC hit piece does us harm because they have this credibility and they come across as so, like Harewood said, as so balanced and fair in the way that they portray themselves, that she thinks it does us harm. Where, you know, other people, you know, even I think from what I've read of what Richard Gage has written already, he thinks it's better that we have that wit than we don't, because people still get to see what happened, and they still, if they're smart enough to pull away the smoke, they can see the evidence. And so, you know, I don't know, there's a mixture of opinions.
I think my position is somewhere in between. I think my position is somewhere in between those two, John. I think yes, it does harm to the truth, because it is deliberately biased and it is deliberately undermining its own, you know, it's betraying its own profession, you know, the profession of what they're meant to be doing. They're undermining it by the way they're doing it. So it's doing a disservice to truth, science, logic. But at the same time, it's doing it in such a poor way. It's not that skillful. It doesn't do it that well. And because it doesn't do it that well, people will see through it. And I see one being a negative, the other being a positive. So, yeah.
So they might as well not have made anything at all. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, we got to see Building 7 collapse on the news here. Now, you know, I really, like I said at the beginning, I think we've won the info war, and they realise that, you know, well, we haven't won it yet, but they know we're going to win it. They know that everyone's going to get the information eventually. So that's why they've had to address it now, and they've addressed it before the official report comes out, because that gives them more room to move. You know, they say that it's only a few months away. Well, we've heard that for a long time. You know, they talked about how they've been working on it for 2 years and trying to make out that that's all they've been doing. But we know that they've been working on it since 2002. And, you know, everything was spun, and it's really a desperate attempt at preserving the official story, because I really can't see it lasting much longer. But I was surprised. I do think these people are very intelligent. And maybe more intelligent than I thought, by the way they use that Larry Silverstein comment. And that's people have been making arguments the last 2 days that the Larry Silverstein argument was a trap. And I know Harewood and I had argued over this a long time ago, about why would Larry say what he said? You know, he's incriminating himself. Is he trying to protect himself?
Comment.
Or was he trying to cause speculation and trying to cause, you know, misinformation in a way by saying, pull it? And, you know, the way in this documentary they leave out the bit and then we watch the building collapse in his quote, that was even smarter again, because it causes us to argue about them and keep talking about Larry's comment. Larry's comment means nothing. It's really not, it's not courtable evidence. Just like the other witness testimony, what was the name of the fellow that worked in the Building 7, Barry? Is that right, Harold?
Yeah, Barry Jennings.
Well,
I
think that's, from what I've seen, I think Barry's testimony is not courtable, because they'd have him talking in riddles very, very quickly, because he's, to me, already seems like he's not really sure what happened.
Well, I think his testimony is, I mean, definitely, potentially, I mean, he's a government official. He's, you know, he was there, he's a witness. I mean, he's definitely someone who...
There's certain things he knows about that could be taken as fact, but a good lawyer could turn him around in a certain different areas and cast doubt on what he was saying. A single witness is not enough. And what Larry said is not enough. We need to forget about these
well,
things.
Well, look, really instead of the testimonies, there's physical evidence. There's
the
evidence
physical.
Everywhere.
That's what James sticks to.
Yeah. Look, John, if people want to find out more about 9/11 Truth Actions, I guess they go to 9/11 Truth, truthaction.org.au.
They do, or they go to Harewood's site at 911oz.com, and I repost everything there. Also post at truthaction.com.
That's the international Truth Action site.
And if they want to join my email list, Harewood's got his email list that he sends out with 911oz info. I send a more regular email out. You can get that at johnbursell@aap.net.au. That's also on the forum at 911oz. Or you can contact me through the truthaction.org.au website. We continue to grow as a group, and all the people that come along are very friendly, and everybody should feel welcome to attend. And, we can't lose, so people should get on board and they can feel like they're achieving something, at least while we've still got enough rights to better do what we're doing.
Absolutely, before they arrest you for wearing a T-shirt. All right, John, well, it's been lovely talking to you, and we'll see you tomorrow at the Truth Action in Sydney.
No worries. I'll be looking forward to seeing you, Josh, and we'll get to talking about those events in September, the Truth Trilogy coming up in September, September 11, 12, and 13.
Fantastic. Well, I'll see you there.
Okay. See you. Bye.
Welcome back to the show. In part two of tonight's show, we have a surprise guest, mathematician, scholar, philologist, and logician, Dan Collins. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Herbert.
It's great to have you aboard.
Good
evening, Josh. Dan, you've been listening in on our discussions up till now, and I know you've got a lot to say about all these topics, but we're going to move on because we've got a few other regional topics that we need to cover, and I'd love to get some of your insights onto
polemical
and apply all of that massive brain power that you've got to some of these questions. So what we're going to move on with our first topic in the Australian news section is a story about censorship, and the title of the story is published at news.com.au, Porn Block Trial is Complete. Now, this is a trial of a system which is able to block your access to naughty things that you're not supposed to be able to see on the internet. Now, I'll just read you the short story here from news.com.au. The federal government has completed a trial of blocking pornography and other online content deemed inappropriate for children at the internet service provider level. A report on the participants and results has been sent to Communications Minister Stephen Conroy. Australian Communications and Media Authority spokesperson Donald Robertson said. Now, the interesting point here to make, which I'll just bring up, is that they say pornography and other online content deemed inappropriate for children. Wow. Gee, that's pretty clear, isn't it? And that leaves it, very clear as to what they mean.
And let's just look at this for children bit. Now, if it's at the ISP level, how's the ISP going to know if it's a kid looking at it? Or if it's someone over the age of 18.
How indeed? And why do we need to have it blocked at the internet provider level? Why cannot the head of the household, the parent, make that decision? Why are they taking the choice away from the parent of the child?
Well,
What's going on?
Because it's not for what they want it for. Of course, it's another guise. It's their favorite disguise. Using children and pornography is and abuse is always a way to bring in an agenda, because who in their right mind wouldn't want to protect children? You know, if you stand up to this and you say, hang on, this is ridiculous, then, oh, you must be a pedophile, or what's wrong with you, mate? Don't you want to protect the children? It's a very hard case to fight. But it's so blatant that trying to set up, because you can't just set up something at an ISP. That's why there's been a big federal trial, because it takes a lot of technology and a lot of hard work and money to get this working. Now, the reason why they've done that is because they, just like China, want to build a great big wall where you are only allowed to see what they want you to see.
A firewall,
great firewall of China is going to be built around everywhere. Now, folks, this isn't some sort of thing that will never happen. Ah, it's too big. Seriously, there is a lot of money riding on the fact that we are taking away eyeballs from mainstream media sources and putting them onto radio shows like this and other alternative news and alternative blogs, alternative information out there that they don't want you to see, A, and B, want your eyeballs for their stuff so they can sell you advertising.
Now, I'd just like to throw into the mix here another story which is related in concept to this. A teen was arrested this week for a T-shirt. For wearing a T-shirt, a teenager has now been arrested and charged.
Okay, now there was a lot of extra police powers given because of this Youth Week, Global Youth Day or something, the Catholic Youth Week, that would allow police to basically arrest or fine or both, and the fine is $5,500 for insulting or being inappropriate around pilgrims.
Yes, they didn't want the pilgrims to be annoyed.
So
they've actually passed some new law, and then by an incredible streak of chance, a teenager was arrested walking down the street with a T-shirt. Now, the T-shirt does say something rather unpleasant.
Well, it does, but at the end of the...
Jesus is a something that we're not
Jesus
allowed to say.
Is a C-word.
Yeah.
And the C-word is the C-word. And then...
Well, can I just butt in and say...
Indeed.
Well, the funny thing is, the actual... one of the instances that actually triggered the French Revolution was the public outrage with the there was some monks who were traveling down a road in France, and some a local peasant didn't kneel in front of them, and so the monks actually like violently tortured him and killed him. And apparently there was some law back then that said can't remember, was it the privileges of all the different levels of state, and this was one of the privileges of the monks,
that they could rip someone apart.
No, they had to be people had to do obeisance before them. And this is one of the acts that triggered the French Revolution, and abat tous les privileges, they used to put priests and whatnot in the guillotine, and
fascinating.
Anyway, funny thing was, I was actually like in Stressful Station of all places.
Yeah.
And I once saw like there was this massive cordon of cops, right, hanging around. And I thought, oh, here's trouble. And all it was, there was a Lebanese guy and his girlfriend standing up on the platform, and he had a T-shirt saying, Lebs do it better. Now, and this guy's one T-shirt had attracted this whole cordon of, this whole, scrum of policemen.
What were the police doing, if I may ask?
Well, this guy was just wearing a provocative T-shirt, and it provoked this reaction,
Look, it is absolutely absurd, A, for the police to get powers to fine people for an offensive T-shirt, because at the end of the day, they are restricting freedom of speech. Because what is on your T-shirt is speech. It's in a text format, and you're you're usually putting out there some sort of slogan or a comical satire or something of the sort. Now, the fact of the matter is this was from a band called Cradle of Filth. It's another heavy metal, death metal
band. But
it's
harmless.
It's harmless rubbish. I mean, they've been trying to shock, heavy metal's been trying to shock the religious establishment ever since the 1960s. You know, metal since the, and then when it got really heavy in the 80s, it was always trying to shock and be provocative, and you know we had people biting off bats' heads on stage.
Black Sabbath.
In the 1970s, yeah. Punk rockers used to vomit over their audience.
Yeah, you know it's about provocative nature, and these teenagers wearing a shirt with a nun on the front masturbating, and Jesus is a C word on the back. Look, it's a shirt. If you don't like it, go up to them and say, excuse me, but that shirt is extremely offensive to me.
The incredible thing about this to me, folks, is that 10, 20, 30 years ago, this wouldn't have even got anywhere. I mean, what we are saying now was so much the norm of what was expected in the 70s, 80s and 90s.
That's right.
The funny thing is I've spent most of my life growing up in an environment where unjust laws are being rolled back. Had been gradually removed. The law against homosexuality. In the 1960s, it was a crime to have sex with someone of the same sex. Now that law was abolished sometime. While I was very young, that law was abolished. And as I grew up, Aborigines didn't have the right to vote when I was born. That was brought in 1968. I've lived a life where most of my early life has been seeing unjust, draconian rules removed and freedoms brought in.
Yeah.
Ever since 2001, I've seen one after the next of all of our freedoms gradually being taken away again.
Well, can I just add to that? You're actually also arguing fundamentally about the consistency of law. I mean, these specious laws about annoying pilgrims on World Youth Day, they tend to contradict other laws. They tend to be unnecessary in one way because we have existing laws for people who do antisocial conduct. And, why do we need more laws?
We have a law for the rich and a law for the poor.
Well, exactly. With the inconsistency laws. I mean, why do we need special laws that mandate special behavior with this special event? I mean, it's inconsistent. And I mean, inconsistent laws are anathema to jurisprudence.
Well, the fact of the matter is, we live in a free society, and part of being in a free society is you are going to get offended. That's just it. You are going to get offended by what people think and talk about and speak about. And it's your right to speak up and say that you're offended and gather your other peers that are offended at the same thing and try to change things about that. But it is not part of living free to have the police state coming down and choosing which person's T-shirt is offensive to them. And, as soon as they get tasers, they'll soon enough taser them because they were resisting arrest because it's so obscene that someone's arresting me because of my T-shirt. So they'll start going, oh, no.
While we're on the subject of police brutality, allow me to move on to our next topic, which we must consider tonight. A solicitor in Sydney just last week was charged after intervening in a drug search at a pub. Now, when I say intervening, that's the headline from Sydney Morning Herald, okay? And you can Google that. Solicitor charged after intervening in drug search at pub. Now, what the man did was he offered the hapless person who was being strip searched by the police in the Cooper's Arms Hotel in Newtown.
In a hotel.
He offered man his business card. And he said, I can be of some service to you. Now, let me just articulate for you what was going on. The lawyer was having dinner, sitting, minding his own business, eating dinner. 10 police come in with dogs, and the dogs begin sniffing everyone in the hotel, walking around, probably sniffing their crotches, right? I mean, you're trying to relax. It's a weekend. You're out to have a few beers and a bite to eat, and a jackbooted policeman comes in with a giant German Shepherd into a restaurant and sniffs your crotch.
Well, it's absolutely absurd. It is.
I mean, I find it hard to contain myself on this. This has been going on for a few years now.
So you're sitting there at the pub. All of a sudden, the door swings open. 10 police come in with their dogs and start sniffing people willy-nilly.
Are these under the auspices of, like, anti-terror laws?
Oh, they would be in there.
These are actually special drug squads. This has got nothing to do with anti-terrorism. This started a few years ago. I don't know when it started. I don't know how they got the authority to do it. It's an absolute invasion, an absolute insult to human rights.
Well, again,
and there are people who have allergies to dogs, and there are people like Muslims who have religious reasons why they cannot touch a dog. To bring dogs into contact with people in a place where there is eating and drinking, it should be illegal.
Well, again,
the act of merely bringing a dog into a place like that should be immediately banned.
Again, the consistency of law. I mean, you know, a pub is also it's a private establishment. It's not like the public street. It's a private establishment. And I mean, I'm not actually like an expert on police law or anything, but the point is, I mean, I'm not sure the police are allowed to come onto someone's property, private property, and search without a warrant. And now, these people didn't sound like they had a warrant at all.
Well, it would be like some of the police coming in right now into my home with dogs.
Well, I'm not sure they can do that. I mean, they might be now under these new anti-terror laws. Hell, they can do anything they want, apparently. But you see what I'm saying? Like, consistency of law. I don't
understand. Truth News is going to investigate and we'll find out.
Look, the folks, Australia is slowly, well, not even slowly anymore. It's quite quickly turning into a police state. Now, if you don't know what police state means, it means where the state has so much power that just anything you do or say is you're basically the judge is right. The police are the judge, the jury, and the executioner. They'll just come in, charge you with whatever, slam you to the ground, say you're not wearing the right t-shirt, or we're just going to sniff you. You know, traditionally, you'd need some sort of warrant or some sort of case built against you to even have the dog come up and sniff you or to search you. They'd need some sort of reason. Now, they just randomly go around at big festivals, they'll randomly go around at pubs, at the train station, and just sniff your crutch.
But I think this is under the auspices of these new terror laws. They've got these new police powers.
Well, you may be right.
I think it's all tied in. Absolutely.
I don't remember them ever doing that. I mean, I don't even know whether their actual operating procedures are actually dictated by codes of conduct written by the police commissioner or by regulations or by acts of parliament. But, you know, it's getting in crazy. And I think there's this creeping spirit where they are just breaking the laws and doing illegal things.
It's called colour of law. This technique of assuming a law that it doesn't exist is called colour of law. I could stop you in the street and say, you can't walk down the street because you're wearing the wrong coloured sand shoes, you know? And if I say that, you know, I might have just made it up. But if I'm a policeman, and you are a law abiding, you know, citizen, and I say something as a policeman, it doesn't even have to be law. I'll say it, and I may be completely mad. I may be making it up. But the police can do it simply because of their uniform.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at in England now, they've just recently made all their parking inspectors have police powers to arrest people. You know, and this is happening globally, folks. Globally, more and more police powers are giving to police.
But I think it's being coordinated, like, internationally. Because there's this sort of spirit of just of insanity. They're doing things that aren't legal. They're putting it in a meta-legal way. They're writing regulations and writing, you know, rules of conduct, but there's nothing legal to them.
In the United States, protesters have been arrested for wearing a 9/11 Truth T-shirt, and the police have said, "Oh, you can't wear that. you know, and they've been arrested, and of course they have to get let out later. I mean, it's made up, and in many cases, you know, they can be sued. And
well, that's what you do, folks. If something like that happens to you, you have to sue the police officer that arrested you or whatever in a civil court, and that will teach them. Because if we don't stand up for our rights, then they'll just be slapped away from us as quick as can be. Talking of lawyers and these T-shirt banning laws, the Council on Civil Liberties is tomorrow, the 11th of July, taking the government to court about this. So it'll be quite interesting to see the outcome of that.
That is good news.
Yeah, it's very good news. And good on you, Council of Civil Liberties.
And also, good on you, Solicitor Christian Bolwell, who is the solicitor concerned who was arrested by the police, had his ribs broken, was handcuffed, head slammed under the table, charged for offering a man his business card. Now, Christian Bolwell, and we're going to be getting in touch with him.
No, I think we should have him on the show, yeah.
He is a leader of the protest movement against the Pope laws.
Jeez, isn't that fascinating? So he was in there having a meal and instantly got attacked by these over-the-top police powers.
Interesting, isn't it? Interesting coincidence. Obviously, he's not the sort of person the police are, you know, particularly friendly towards. I don't know if they knew who he was.
Well, look,
he's an activist lawyer.
Basically, what would have happened? The police would have come in, started charging all these strangers that are minding their own business, having something to eat, yeah. And he would have seen that they were unjustly treated, and said, "Look, being a civil libertarian and offering him them his legal counsel," and then he would have had his head slammed into the ground by the police and ribs broken.
And in the original article, which is published in the newspaper, there is a photograph, a mobile phone photograph, which shows a man with his pants pulled down. Now, this is not in the internet.
In the pub?
I can only assume it is. I mean, and in the caption it said, mobile phone taken off strip search. And that's part of the article in the paper.
So somebody was strip searched in front of all these other civilians.
I can only...
Wasn't even taken away.
I can only assume that. I mean... Maybe they took him to a small room, but where would you take someone? Where would they have taken him? To the men's room? I mean, you're in a pub. Where are they going to take someone to do a strip search? I mean,
well, honestly, folks.
Like anti-terror laws, it's all under the umbrella of these anti-terror laws. I mean,
yeah, it is.
It's been going on in America. I mean, even Alex Jones was talking about it, how they've been throwing people charged with crimes. You know, they've been sort of like people with charged with crimes that got nothing to do with, you know, with terror, and they've been charging them, you know, pursuing them under the Patriot Act, you know, and just, you know, with this draconian treatment, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why we are here at truthnews.com.au so engaged in the topic of 9/11, because it was ever since September 11th that they have had the excuse to push terrorism as an agenda to take away civil liberties, to take away human rights, and to use terror laws with the broadest brush possibly imaginable. And this isn't a new thing. You know, it's been happening for centuries, where they use terrorism as a guise to protect, you know, under national security, to then take away civil liberties and rights. And it's time for a song. This is Flobots with Handlebars.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
Look at me, look at me. Hands in the air like it's good to be alive. And I'm a famous rapper even when the paths are all crooked-y. I can show you how to do-si-do. I can show you how to scratch a record. I can take apart the remote control, and I can almost put it back together. I can tie a knot in a cherry stem. I can tell you about Leif Erikson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friend saw a platypus. Me and my friend made a comic book. And guess how long it took? I can do anything that I want, cause look, I can keep rhythm with no metronome. No metronome, no metronome. And I can see your face on the telephone. On the telephone, on the telephone. Look at me, look at me. Just called to say that it's good to be alive. In such a small world, I'm all curled up with a book to read. I can make money, open up a thrift store. I can make a living off a magazine. I can design an engine, 64 miles to a gallon of gasoline. I can make new antibiotics. I can make computers survive aquatic conditions. I know how to run the business, and I can make you want to buy a product. Movers, shakers, and producers. Me and my friends understand the future. I see the strings that control the system. I can do anything with no resistance, cause I can lead a nation with a microphone. With a microphone, with a microphone. And I can split the atom of a molecule. Of a molecule, of a molecule. My reach is global, my tower secure, my cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from the lacerations, have them all killed by assassination. I can make anybody go to prison, just because I don't like them. And I can do anything with no permission. I have it all under my command, because I can guide a missile by satellite, by satellite, by satellite. And I can hit a target through a telescope, through a telescope, through a telescope. And I can end the planet in a holocaust, 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 in a holocaust. With no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars. I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars, no handlebars.
And that was the Flowbots with Handlebars.
Wow, Josh, that was quite an amazing song.
Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it?
I can ride a bike with no handlebars. I get some interesting ideas from that song that they're kind of saying, like, the theme is like taking a childlike thing, you know, the impressiveness of being able to do something clever.
Yeah.
And then showing you what happens when that kind of childlike mentality then becomes more and more clever, able to do things, but still without an emotional...
Split an atom or, yeah.
Without, but still without an emotional maturity.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Is that the idea behind the song? Because that's what I got from it.
That's what you took from it. Yeah. Can
we find that on YouTube? Well, how do we find that?
Yeah,
song?
just Google the Flowbots.
The Flowbots.
That's FLO without a W, BOTS. That's FLOBOTS, and the song's called Handlebars. Yeah, I like how it's, you know, starts off very naive and young,
yeah,
and to then splitting it at him, and then to becoming a megalomaniac,
yeah,
who can have a holocaust if he wants to and put people in prison that he doesn't like. And then right at the end, after all the big holocaust, just goes back to the handlebars, you know, to give you that sense of perspective.
What do you think about that term?
Well, yeah, it's a peculiarly, I mean, living in Australia, I mean, it's just one of the subtleties in American culture you don't pick up on is just that, you know, the techno worship that's so prevalent. You know, everything's, you know, everything's the latest, the greatest, the newest, bleeding edge, you know, and that's sort of, you know, this sort of like, you know, this kind of imperative and this kind of icon and this idol in American culture is this technocracy and this, you know, this the new and the fantastic and the
and this kind of boyish, really, you know, childish glee. I mean, I think of George Bush standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier, saying "Mission accomplished." You know, yeah. like an 11-year-old. You know,
well, he had the Wiggles having, in the background with all the coloured T-shirts. It was quite childlike.
yeah.
The purple and the yellow.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I mean, it was almost like, you know, it was almost, he's thumbing up. He was some young, you know, young hot kid with his, you know, with the latest, you know, the latest.
I can take out a country.
Yeah. The latest gadget saying, you know, I can do things that the previous generation told Sid he couldn't do. And, all these, you know, their kind of moral imperatives and, you know, all that kind of mumbo jumbo, you know, I've got my new alloy, you know, machine and I've done it, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, the next topic, Harrowood.
Yeah. Our next story and last story for tonight. And I'd like to get Dan to apply his juridical mind to this interesting little conundrum.
Massive juridical mind.
MP blocked from shopping centre demands change. That's the title from the Sydney Morning Herald, July 7th, 2008. Story. Gary Gray was on the hustings last year when he was confronted by a serious hurdle to democracy in the 21st century. He was denied entry to a shopping centre. Yes, folks, a politician, well-established, doing something that politicians do, which is meeting people in public, was denied access to a public space. Now, it says here that other centres had let him in after charging him a whopping $460 to set up
absurd.
His card table. Indeed. But in this particular shopping centre, Mr. Gray, her leading Labor election strategist, was told, in fact, sorry, you can't come in here. Now, this is one case, and one case does not prove or disprove anything. It is merely taking the temperature of our democracy. However, the principle of it is private shopping centres being private space, the owner can decide whatever they want. If they don't like you, if they don't like your clothes you're wearing, they don't like anything about you, they can say, get out of here. It's private space. Now, as more and more of our public space becomes privatised, and there are big plans for this in Sydney. I don't know if you've read some of the plans for the centre of Sydney. They want to make the whole, they want to rebuild the whole CBD. Now, when they did this in Liverpool, you know what happened? The entire CBD of Liverpool in the UK is private. It's private property.
Wow.
The entire, they've got a mall, a town square. It's all private property.
Yeah.
And it's already happened that it's policed by their own private security guards, and if they see a beggar or they see someone they don't like, they kick them out. This is already happening.
See, this it is incredible, isn't it? And it's a very good, valid point and very astute find, because when you have too much, I mean, these are public spaces, and the article does say, you know, this is the churches and the parks of today are the shopping centres where all the people hang out, you know. In fact, I've got a T-shirt, funnily enough, I've got a T-shirt that says a shopping centre is a poor excuse for a community.
Mm. Dan?
Yeah, the mall. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but obviously what's happened is the law hasn't caught up with the corporate world. I mean... We're faced with this kind of lurid scene of you know anyone who's dressed in rags going into Westfield, and you know immediately the security people are onto him, like you know they're not talking to him, but they're standing next to him or following him around, or you know, someone in ragged clothes or dirty clothes, or you know.
Well, I've seen a We Are Change video of some 9/11 truth activists giving out some information at a mall, them getting kicked out for handing out leaflets. They weren't even getting read. The security guard hadn't even read the leaflets.
Wow.
And then they then stood just outside the private property giving out leaflets to all the shoppers.
Mm.
They then came out and threatened them even further, and there was this whole debacle of this is actually public land out here, And then they finally got told, well, you can come back in if you stop handing out anything. So they did, and they met up with some girlfriends that they knew from college or something like that in there at the food court, and they were sitting there and they were just talking about what had happened to them. And one of them had shown them one of the leaflets that they were giving out, and instantly four security guards, boom, or something like that, grabbed them, threw them out, and said that we've got your face now and you're never allowed back here ever again.
No, it's kind of threatening, but how would they really reinforce that? I mean,
but once what?
Yeah, well, exactly. But the concept is there, Dan. You know, I mean, that's the thing is that
the bluff. I mean, you know, but you know, they can't like. You know, I mean, even common law doesn't, you know, as far as I know, you know, allow people like, you know, beat people up and push them around, even if they're on your land. I mean, you've still got to obey laws. You know.
No, but shopping centers where you buy your groceries from, you don't have the local farmer there down the road anymore. You don't have the farmer's markets. I mean, you do, but in a lot of these places, the only place to get food and basic amenities and basic living things is from there. And for them to ban you from ever stepping on this private property again, which is a threat and a bluff, and it's a very hard one to police. But the fact of the matter is that it was there. And now when we take this back to Australia and say that this politician isn't allowed to canvass for his, his views on policies, all of a sudden the private owner of this big community grounds, this public grounds, says, well, I don't like his policies. I'm never going to let him, you know, talk or canvass here ever again. It's quite dangerous.
I mean, we've allowed it to occur by allowing in so many different ways, so many, you know, incrementally, you see, we've allowed these situations to develop. And I don't think we saw it coming. I don't think we understood when the first gleaming shopping centres were created what was being done. I think the general populace was seduced by them, you know.
Oh, they're great, aren't they?
Gleaming palaces.
All the shops are there at once, and you don't need to walk far, and you can walk around all day, especially when you're a teenager. I mean, you just hang there, don't you? You just hang around. You can go to the food court and you do this and that. But then when you grow up and then these sort of stories start coming out, you start questioning the validity of the owner being able to say who's allowed to go in there. And
of course, the shopping centre becomes a club of, you know, the elite of the commercial world. Because, you know, if you're in small business, there's no way you can afford to rent.
Oh, it's extremely hard.
A property. I mean, you can't rent. I mean, the only shops in those places are all owned by chains. They're all huge, powerful companies that dominate the entire landscape.
Well, it's funny. You know, if you own a franchise or a shop there, usually a franchise, like you're saying, Westfields is the only place that you have to actually divulge how much your shop has earned in that financial year. And
really?
And if you earned, and you have to earn a certain amount, and if you earn a certain amount, you have to pay more for your rent.
Yeah, well, that... Yeah, I mean, that's Westfield specifically, but I mean, one thing I've noticed about on the public-private spaces thing is, like, especially at Hornsby Westfields, this is kind of courtyard, which is actually public space, but it's sort of right smack bang in the middle of Westfields, because, you know, Westfields, Hornsby is made up of this, what was usually Northgate plus the old Westfields plus this other mall, which is another private, Florence Street. And so it's kind of like this cluster. And right where the fountain is, it's public space. But you're not allowed, but for some reason, if you try to sit up there and busk or you try to like hand out flyers, you know, the cops will be on you like an angry mob of hornets. And it's insane, like they're enforcing Westfields policy at the taxpayer's expense. I mean, they don't let... You know, there's this every Thursday. There's this cutesy kind of you know, organic food market, but other than that, you know, there's no buskers. There's no like, but it's not Westfield space. You know, it's Hornsby Council. I don't even know, But you know exactly what the mall with the hall, the courtyard with the.
So you're saying the police actually aggressively prevent people from?
Well, I actually once was harassed by the cops, not Westfield Security, because it's just sort of like it's just kind of like Twilight Zone, because it's not it's not private, it's not public, but it's policed at the taxpayer's expense, doing what the job for the Westfield Security guards. I mean, it's kind of, that's what we're talking about. It's just sort of like this.
Yeah, it's a pseudo. It's a mixture of private, corporate, and public policing fascism, isn't it? Really, I mean, that's what it boils down to when you get this mixture of corporatism and publicly funded police.
It's like someone's doing something not in Westfield's interest, and so they ring the cops,
What were you harassed for, Dan?
Handing out 9/11 truth deception dollars.
Oh, good on you. Good on you. So when did this occur exactly?
All my life. No, 6 months ago, I think.
So you were handing out deception dollars.
Yeah,
deception dollars are a note that look like the American dollar with a whole heap of 9/11 truth URLs and information, and it's a great looking little thing. You can buy
go to deceptiondollar.com.
Deceptiondollar.com.
Yeah, well, I hand them out whenever I can and get a spare moment. Yeah.
Now, just if you could just recount the process, because so you were there in this little courtyard area, and you were handing out the dollars to people.
Well, actually, at that time I was handing out my own flyers regarding David Hicks. Actually, I was handing out those as well. But I was handing out flyers regarding David Hicks.
And you were approached by a policeman?
Yes.
And what were the words that the policeman used?
I can't remember. He said, I'm not allowed to, what's the word, not a beggar, peddler.
A hawk?
Hawkers, yeah.
Tout?
But I mean, I think you're allowed to hawker and tout in public, aren't you?
Well, you are. You're allowed to do whatever you want in public. We're allowed to give up information.
That's why I'd like to get the details of what really occurred, because it's quite interesting.
I mean, yeah, but not these days. This day and age, if you want information, you have to turn on your television. That's the only way you ever get your information. You can't get it old school way of actually passing information to each other peer-to-peer.
Talking to someone. Oh, God.
Talking to someone, geez.
Well,
was it a pair of them? They usually
it was just
pairs.
One policeman, but I couldn't be bothered.
You weren't offending pilgrims, were you?
Well, almost. I mean, I actually went up to the Barker College and started. It was like 3 PM, and I started handing out 911 stuff to the school kids.
See, that's what they'll use against you. Continue.
No, I mean, that was the same day, but that's my point about private public spaces. It's
we had an experience last year. I was with the Australian Sydney 9/11 Truth Action Group. We were down at Town Hall, and we were approached by police and council representatives. We were told that we had committed an offence.
Oh, yeah, I saw the video of that.
Yeah. We were told we committed an offence. And the offence was that we had a banner.
Yeah, I love this.
And that the legs of the banner were touching the ground.
Yeah. So you had a banner saying 9/11 truth or whatever it said. Yeah. And their grounds for coming up and talking to you and asking you to move on was that the banner legs were touching the ground. So what did you guys do?
Well, we lifted it 1 inch off the ground.
Were these council officers or policemen?
We were first approached by the council. We're actually in front of the town hall, and you could see a guy came out of the building, and he was obviously an official. He had a suit on, and he was watching us very carefully. And then a few minutes later, the council, city police came, right? Not the full uniform police, but the council police, and they made a big hoo-ha about it, and they said, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to have a card table, you're not allowed to batter must not touch the ground, blah blah blah.
I've been at protests which have had tables there.
Yes, well they said no, this time we're letting you off with a caution, However, you are actually committing an offence and we could fine you $350.
Oh, I think it's a lot of imposture there. I mean...
And shortly after that, the police turned up. And the police stood there for a long time. And apparently I was not close to the area where the police were.
Can the police legally enforce council regulations?
Well, the police just came really to...
It doesn't matter what they can legally or not do anymore. It's the colour of law, as you were saying, and they'll just enforce something. And just like you said, they can just do anything. They can do and say anything. Do you know, folks, there are so many laws, and this is what I keep coming back to. There is an infinite amount of laws that the cops... If a cop came up to me in the street, they could get me for something.
Yeah.
For something. And, you know, when I'm driving down the street and I see a cop car next to me, you know, everyone feels this. They start feeling nervous, like they're driving along, you know, am I speeding? You start looking at your speedo. Yeah. You're looking if you're doing anything, or you drive as like some sort of ridiculously careful grandpa. Because they could instantly just go, boo, pull you over and something.
It's a very convincing siren. Yeah, you like just that? Made.
Yeah.
True, but I'm just saying, the flip side, you know, you've got to know that this whole meta-legal, I'm a bit astonished to discover, like, especially in the United States, and these declarations by the United States president, I mean, this kind of insane vanity of the executive office. Now, they've been... Even like Bush has invented these signing statements where he like signs a statement and it becomes law. Now, the executive can't actually make law, but they've been trying to advance this theory that the signing statements of the executive officer, like the president, are like a kind of have weight in like in common law.
Yeah, forget the Senate. Forget passing laws through Senate.
I mean, are they actually going to advance to go up to the Supreme Court and say, well, you know, which apparently they do, that they... They come up with, you know, the president signed a decree, you know, like saying, which has some weight in law, which it doesn't. And, yeah. I mean, these sort of absolutely unconstitutional, you know, especially in that law that they tried to pass in the Senate about, you know, making, you know, phone companies, you know, sort of...
Passing the liability.
Yeah, yeah.
So not, the phone companies aren't liable for the spying.
I mean, that contradicts the Constitution. I mean, they cannot...
Yeah, absolutely.
You cannot actually... It's just this whole farce. They are going through the motions of legality. They're, you know...
Well, they do it the same with telling you that you have to get your kids inoculated with vaccines. That it's law. And there is no law. They'll just say there is. They'll just say there is in all pamphlets and leaflets and on the radio. And there isn't actually a law that says you have to. There's other laws that say... Your kid can't go to school unless he's vaccinated. Well, but there's no law saying...
When I hear recommendations from the government that every child under the age of 5 should get the flu vaccine, this again, seems to me an incredible assumption to make that is just unwarranted. I mean... The flu vaccine is not even, it's hard to know. I mean, these things that they announce as recommendations don't really make a lot of sense.
Well, speaking of vaccinations, this was in the Sunday Telegraph on the 6th of July. Cancer jabs linked to illnesses in girls. Now, this is the Gardasil cervical cancer. I'll just read a section of it. The new cervical cancer jab is believed to be behind a huge jump in the number of women and girls suffering bad reactions to vaccinations in New South Wales. The first annual state vaccination statistics to include Gardasil reveal that 1,600% surge. That's a 1,600% surge in reported adverse side effects among young females who were immunized last year. These include allergic reactions.
Oh, this is such a tragedy. Do you know that 2 million young women have been vaccinated with this poisonous thing?
Well, this vaccination has got a live cancer virus in it. You're getting injected with a live cancer virus. They don't actually know what that does, what sort of autoimmune response that gives. But they're going to find soon because millions of people have been injected. Now, it's funny. I love the quote here by the mother of one of the children who have been extremely sick after her inoculation. The quote is, "I was concerned about her having the vaccination because we knew the government has supported it." So there you have a person being scared of getting this vaccination because the government's, you know, sponsoring it.
Well, yeah, actually, this makes me think of something about, you know, like the recent Richard Dawkins thing on the ABC.
No, I must have missed that.
Well, you know, his War on Reason, was it? His latest series where he was talking about, he was talking about the fact that a lot of Britons have actually neglected to vaccinate their children. And he was blaming on some kind of pseudoscience.
Richard Dawkins. Where do we? We'll have to do a whole program on him.
Yeah.
But my point really, my point was that, you know, he was saying, you know, there's this new, this rise of new pseudoscience that have, you know, have put the peasants into a tizzy, and you know, and they're no longer vaccinating their children, which and I just want to say that the point originally started that the government originally was blamed Gulf War illness on vaccinations.
Interesting.
No, but I mean, this is what I'm saying, this was the government BS originally. They said that they tried to squeeze out of liability for the whole Gulf War, you know, depleted uranium liability thing. They tried to squeeze out of it by saying, oh, it's vaccinations.
Look, can I just say, the claim that cancer is caused by a virus is unsubstantiated twaddle, okay? The theory that cancer can be caused by a virus has been raised time and time again since the early 70s. It's never been proven. The cancer is a complex problem that has complex causes, right?
I'm sure cancer
is produced by toxins primarily. It's well known that there are carcinogens, okay? To try and oversimplify, this is what they do. They oversimplify everything. And they try to give you a magic bullet, a silver bullet then solution for the oversimplified problem. But when they do that, whenever they do that, the silver bullet solution they give you is going to make you sick every case.
Yeah, I've never heard of a cancer vaccination. I don't know.
Absurd. There's no science. It's pseudoscience. It's babble. It's just childlike nonsense that has somehow been foisted onto us without any proper scientific oversight. We're living in a cowboy environment where just commercialism reigns. Pharmaceutical companies have the government in their pocket. They can engineer anything that they want to occur, and then you hear on the news that it's scientific fact proven, and you better get your children vaccinated tomorrow to be safe.
Yes, because some doctor who's been paid by the pharmaceuticals is saying that it's safe.
I won't get my daughter vaccinated, but all my point really was that, you know, the government was to blame for this hysteria in the first place. They were saying, you know, the vaccinations caused Gulf War syndrome. So a lot of people freaked out and said, the government is saying that the vaccinations are causing hideous birth defects. So they decided they weren't going to have their children. I mean, this was, you know, the government said it.
Yeah, let's not look about at DU, you know, depleted uranium.
But my point was, Richard Dawkins was now railing against pseudoscientific religious mumbo jumbo as the cause for this, the people turning away from vaccination, but it was the government themselves who started the hysteria by trying to, you know, by some lame way of getting out of liability in the first place.
Now, there is a very important fact about the Gardasil trials, which you might have access to there in that article. I'm not sure. But what I know is that when they did the placebo test to see the efficacy of the vaccine, it turned out that thousands of people who received the placebo became quite ill. Reason being, they put the aluminium in the placebo. And it's the aluminium, as much as anything else, it's the aluminium in the vaccine which is causing these terrible side effects, so-called side effects.
Aluminium compounds.
I don't think it's a side effect. I think it's the primary effect.
Aluminium compounds.
But the aluminium compounds were also in the placebo. And so what they did was, because the people getting the placebo were getting sick, they didn't count the reaction as being significant. In other words, anyone who got sick after getting the vaccination was not counted as a side effect because the people who got the placebo got sick. I mean, can you actually follow what I'm saying here? Because it's quite incredible. They gave X number of people a placebo. They gave Y number of people the real vaccine.
Yeah.
They all got sick, right?
Yeah.
And because the people who got the so-called placebo got sick,
yeah,
they said, oh, well, getting sick doesn't mean there's anything wrong because the placebo is supposedly harmless. But they put the aluminium in the placebo.
Well, yeah, it's great consuming aluminium, isn't it? Yeah. Look, it just goes on and on. And I really would recommend people to look into vaccinations too because, yeah. I mean, the concept of vaccinations is absolutely valid. It could work. You know, people can be vaccinated for things. But a lot of these vaccinations are created by companies that really don't give a hoot.
No.
And there are also
a rat's hind quarter.
You know, I mean, most vaccinations in the States, and I'm not sure about Australia, but in the States, is still using the mercury mercury-based preservatives, which are, you know, linked very heavily to Alzheimer's,
neurological damage.
Variety of problems. But aluminium too. I mean, there are all these compounds in these vaccines. I mean, you're damaging yourself. I mean,
honestly, guys, feed your kids good nutrition, good vegetables, good fruit. Some, you know, get yourself a good understanding of nutrition. That's what's important. Nutrition and exercise.
I mean, look, you will get the flu. I mean, we all get the flu. I mean,
flus are very, very important. It's like you going to the gym. It's like your immune system going for a gym workout having the flu.
And when you get the flu, what it says is, what your body's saying is, take it easy. Rest.
Yeah.
Don't abuse yourself. Stay off the drugs. Stay off the booze. Just get good rest. And sleep well.
No, but Harold, the TV says, soldier on with Codrill. Soldier on. You have to keep on going. Keep on going. Yes. You know, it's ridiculous. So it's important, folks, to realize that, you know, you need rest. If you're feeling a bit down and run down, you need good nutrition. And nutrition doesn't mean fat content. It doesn't mean...
Not at all, by any stretch.
You know, it means looking at the proper... And properly understanding vitamins and minerals, you know, understanding how salt is actually good for you, in good amounts, and all sorts. Because, you know, it's really important that you do that and not just run out there getting vaccinated on every possible thing, you know. Anyway,
ladies and gentlemen, this has been another mega show, and sadly, we really do now draw towards. The end. Yes.
And if you want to look up at any of the show notes, they'll be on there in the next couple of days. We'll be putting the show up straight away, but the show notes will slowly pop up over the next few days. Please leave a comment on truthnews.com.au. You follow the links there to the radio show. The Truth News is still in beta. We're still working on the actual interface of the actual Truth News site, but the radio site where we host the podcast is absolutely up and running, and go and check it out and leave some comments for us. You can also call us on the Skype line, which is Truth News. That's the Skype name, Truth News Radio.
Truth News Radio.
You can call us there and leave us a message, and we'll play the messages that we like. Okay, ciao.
Good night.
Good night.